welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden age. Mark Levone, your host for an hour of horror. Later on, Inner Sanctum from 1947. But first, a well-known story produced on Suspense called The Waxwork, a CBS episode from the 1st of May, 1956.
And now, tonight's presentation of radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense. This evening, Suspense brings you what we feel is a particularly unusual and absorbing story. No actors other than Mr. William Conrad will appear in its presentation. It's a study in terror which has few equals. So now, starring Mr. Conrad, here is tonight's suspense play by A.M. Burridge, The Waxwork.
While the uniformed attendants of Mariner's Waxworks were ushering the last stragglers through the great glass-paneled double doors, the manager sat in his office interviewing Raymond Hewson. The manager was speaking.
Oh, there's nothing new in your request, sir. And in fact, we refuse it to different people, mostly young bloods who've tried to make bets about three times a week, I should say. We have nothing to gain and something to lose by letting people spend the night in our murderer's den. If I allowed it and some young idiot lost his senses, what would be my position, eh? But your being a journalist somewhat alters the case. Hewson smiled.
I suppose you mean that journalists have no senses to lose.
No, of course not. But one imagines them to be responsible people. Well, besides, we have something to gain here. Publicity and advertisement.
Yes, exactly, said Hewson. And there I thought we might come to terms.
The manager smiled.
Yes, I know what's coming. You want to be paid twice, do you? You know, it used to be said years ago that Madame Tussaud would give a man £100 for sleeping alone in the Chamber of Horrors. Well, I hope you don't think that we've made any such offer. What is your paper, Mr. Hewson?
Well, I'm freelancing at present, sir, working on space for several papers. However, I would find no difficulty in getting the story printed. I'm sure the Morning Echo would use it like a shot. A Night with Mariner's Murderers? No live paper could turn it down, sir.
Yes. How do you propose to treat it?
Well, I shall make it gruesome, of course. Gruesome with just a saving touch of humor.
The manager nodded and offered Hewson his cigarette case.
Very well, Mr. Hewson. You'll get your story printed in the Morning Echo, and there'll be a £5 note waiting for you when you care to come and call for it. But, first of all, you realize it's no small ordeal that you're proposing to undertake. I'd like to be quite sure about you. I'd like you to be quite sure about yourself. I own I shouldn't care to take it on. I should hate having to sleep down there, but alone, among them.
Why?
Asked Hewson.
Oh, I don't know. Isn't any reason, I suppose. I don't believe in ghosts. If I did, I should expect them to haunt the scene of their crimes or the spots where their bodies were laid, instead of a cellar which happens to contain their waxwork effigies. Well, it's just that I couldn't sit alone among them all night with their seeming to stare at me in the way they do. After all, they represent the lowest and the most appalling types of humanity. Well, the whole atmosphere of the place is unpleasant. And if you're susceptible to atmosphere, sir, I warn you that you're in for a very uncomfortable night.
Hewson had known that from the moment when the idea first occurred to him. His soul sickened at the prospect. But he had a wife and a family to keep. So here was a chance not to be missed, the price of a special story in the Morning Echo, with a £5 note to add to it. Besides, if he wrote the story well, it might lead to an offer of regular employment. The manager smiled at him and rose.
Well, I think the last of the people must have gone by now. There is one condition I'm afraid I must impose upon you, sir. I must ask you not to smoke. We had a fire scare down in the murderer's den this evening. I don't know who gave the alarm, but whoever it was a false one. Fortunately, there were very few people down there at the time, or there might have been a panic. Ah, now, if you're ready, we'll make a move.
He led the way through an open barrier and down ill-lit stone stairs, which conveyed a sinister impression of giving access to a dungeon. In a passage at the bottom were a few preliminary horrors, such as relics of the Inquisition, a rack taken from a medieval castle, branding irons, thumb screws, and other mementos of man's cruelty to men. Beyond the passage was the murderer's den. It was a room of irregular shape, with a vaulted roof and dimly lit by electric lights burning behind inverted bowls of frosted glass. It was, by design, an eerie and uncomfortable chamber, a chamber whose atmosphere invited its visitors to speak in whispers. The waxwork murderers stood on low pedestals with numbered tickets at their feet. Recent notorieties rubbed dusty shoulders with the old favorites. Thurtell, the murderer of Weir, stood as if frozen in the act of making a shop window gesture to young Bywaters. And there was Lefroy, the poor half-baked little snob who killed for gain so that he might ape the gentleman. Within 5 yards of him sat Mrs. Thompson, that erotic romanticist hanged to propitiate British middle-class matronhood. Charles Peace, the only member of the vile company who looked uncompromisingly and entirely evil, sneered across a gangway at Norman Thorne. Brown and Kennedy, the two most recent additions, stood between Mrs. Dyer and Patrick Mahon. The manager walking around with Houston pointed out several of the more interesting of these unholy notabilities.
That's Crippen. I expect you recognize him, insignificant little beast who looks as if he couldn't tread on a worm. Oh, and that's Armstrong. Looks like a decent, harmless country gentleman, doesn't he? And there's old Vaquier. You can't miss him, of course, because of his beard. And this one...
Who's that? Houston asked in a whisper.
Here, come here, have a good look at him. This is our star turn. He's the only one of the bunch that hasn't been hanged.
The figure which Houston had indicated was that of a small, slight man, not much more than 5 feet in height. It wore little waxed mustaches, large spectacles, and a caped coat. There was something so exaggeratedly French in its appearance that it reminded Hewson of a stage caricature. He could not have said precisely why the mild-looking face seemed to him so repellent, but he had already recoiled a step, and even in the manager's company it cost him an effort to look again. "But who is he?" he asked.
"That," said the manager, "is Dr. Baudet."
Hewson shook his head doubtfully.
I think I've heard the name, but I forget in connection with what."
The manager smiled.
You'd remember better if you were a Frenchman. You know, for some long while, that man was the terror of Paris. He carried on his work of healing by day and of throat cutting by night. Why, he killed for the sheer devilish pleasure it gave him to kill, and always in the same way, with a razor. After his last crime, he left a clue behind him which set the police upon his track. Oh, but he was much too clever for them. When he realized that the coils were closing about him, he mysteriously disappeared. And ever since, the police of every civilized country have been looking for him. There's no doubt that he managed to make away with himself, and by some means which has prevented his body coming to light. One or two crimes of a similar nature have taken place since his disappearance, but he is believed almost for certain to be dead, and the experts believe these recrudescences to be the work of an imitator. It's queer, isn't it, Mr. Hewson, how every notorious murderer has imitators?
Hewson shuddered and fidgeted with his feet.
I don't like him at all. What eyes he's got.
Yes, this figure's a little masterpiece. You'll find the eyes bite into you, huh? Well, that's excellent realism, then, for Boudet practiced mesmerism and was supposed to mesmerize his victims before dispatching them. Indeed, had he not done so, it's impossible to see how so small a man could have done his ghastly work. There were never any signs of struggle.
I thought I saw him move,
said Hewson with a catch in his voice. The manager smiled.
You'll have more than one optical illusion before the night's out, I expect, sir. Well, I'm sorry I can't give you any more light because all the lights are on. For obvious reasons, we keep this place as gloomy as possible, eh? Well, Mr. Hewson, good night.
Hewson wheeled a swivel chair, a heavy one upholstered in plush, a little way down the central gangway, and deliberately turned it so that its back was toward the effigy of Dr. Boudet. For some undefined reason, he liked Dr. Boudet a great deal less than his companions. Busying himself with arranging the chair, he was almost lighthearted. But when the manager's footfalls had died away, and a deep hush stole over the chamber, he realized that he had no slight ordeal before him. The dim, unwavering light fell on the rows of figures which were so uncannily like human beings that the silence and the stillness seemed unnatural and even ghastly. He missed the sound of breathing, the rustling of clothes, the 101 minute noises one hears when even the deepest silence has fallen upon a crowd. And the air was as stagnant as water at the bottom of a standing pond.
It must be like this at the bottom of the sea,
he thought. He faced these sinister figures boldly enough. They were only waxworks. So long as he let that thought dominate all others, he promised himself that all would be well. It did not, however, save him long from the discomfort occasioned by the waxen stare of Dr. Boudet, which he knew was directed upon him from behind. The eyes of the little Frenchman haunted and tormented him, and he itched with a desire to turn and look.
My nerves have started already,
he thought, and then another voice in his brain spoke to him.
It's because you're afraid that you won't turn and look at him.
The two voices quarreled silently for a moment or two, and at last Hewson slewed his chair around a little and looked behind him. Among the many figures standing in stiff, unnatural poses, the effigy of the dreadful little doctor stood out with a queer prominence. Perhaps because of a steady beam of light beat straight down upon it. Hewson flinched before the parody of mildness which some fiendishly skilled craftsman had managed to convey in wax, met the eyes for one agonized second, and then turned again to face the other direction. He's only a waxwork like the rest of you, Hewson muttered defiantly. You're all only waxworks. They were only waxworks, yes. But waxworks don't move. Oh, not that he had seen the least movement anywhere, but it struck him that in the moment or two while he'd looked behind him, there had been the least subtle change in the grouping of the figures in front. Crippen, for instance, seemed to have turned at least 1 degree to the left. Or, thought Hewson, perhaps the illusion was due to the fact that he had not slewed his chair back into its exact original position. Oh, but there were Brown and Kennedy, too. Surely one of them had moved his hands. Hewson held his breath for a moment and then drew his courage back to him as a man lifts a weight. He took a notebook from his pocket and wrote quickly,
Memo, deathly silence and unearthly stillness of figures. Like being at bottom of sea. Hypnotic eyes, Dr. Baudet. Figures seem to move when not being watched.
He closed the book suddenly over his fingers and looked around quickly and awfully over his right shoulder. He had neither seen nor heard a movement, but it was as if some sixth sense had made him aware of one. He looked straight into the vapid countenance of Lefroy, which smiled vacantly back as if to say, "It wasn't I." No, of course, it wasn't he, or any of them. It was his own nerves. Or was it? Then why all that silent unrest about him? A subtle something in the air which did not quite break the silence and happened, whichever way he looked, just beyond the boundaries of his vision. He swung round quickly to encounter the mild but baleful stare of Dr. Baudet. And then, without warning, he jerked his head back to stare straight at Crippen. He'd nearly caught Crippen that time. "You'd better be careful, Crippen, and all the rest of you. If I do see one of you move, I'll smash you to pieces. Do you hear?" He ought to go, he told himself. Already he'd experienced enough to write his story, or 10 stories, for the matter of that. Well, then, why not go? The Morning Echo would be none the wiser as to how long he'd stayed. Nor would it care so long as his story was a good one. Yes, but the manager. One never knew. Perhaps the manager would quibble over that 5-pound note which he needed so badly. He wondered if his wife were asleep or if she were lying awake and thinking of him. She'd laugh when he told her that he'd imagine. That he'd imagine. This was a little too much. It was bad enough that the waxwork effigies of murderers should move when they weren't being watched, but it was intolerable that they should breathe. Somebody was breathing. Or was it his own breath which sounded to him as if it came from a distance? He sat rigid, listening, straining, until he exhaled with a long sigh. His own breath, after all. Or, if not, something had divined that he was listening and had ceased breathing simultaneously. Hewson turned his head swiftly around and looked all about him out of haggard and hunted eyes. Everywhere his gaze encountered the vacant, waxen faces. And everywhere he felt that by just some least fraction of a second he had missed seeing a movement of hand or foot, a silent opening, a compression of lips, a flicker of eyelids, a look of human intelligence now smoothed out. They were like naughty children in a classroom, whispering, fidgeting, and laughing behind their teacher's back, but blandly innocent when his gaze was turned upon them. No. No, this would not do. This distinctly would not do. He must clutch at something, grip with his mind upon something which belonged essentially to the workaday world, to the daylight London streets. He was Raymond Hewson, an unsuccessful journalist, a living and breathing man, and these figures grouped around him were only dummies, so they could neither move nor whisper. Well, what did it matter if they were supposed to be lifelike effigies of murderers? They were only made of wax and sawdust and stood there for the entertainment of morbid sightseers and orange-sucking trippers. Oh, that was better. Now, what was that funny story which somebody had told him in the Falstaff pub yesterday? Oh, yes. He recalled part of it, but not all. For the gaze of Dr. Baudet urged, challenged, and finally compelled him to turn
Hewson half turned and then swung his chair so as to bring him face to face with a wearer of those dreadful hypnotic eyes. His own eyes were dilated, and his mouth at first set in a grin of terror, lifted at the corners in a snarl, and then Hewson spoke and woke 100 sinister echoes.
You moved! Yes, you did, you moved! I saw you! You moved!
Then he sat quite still, staring straight before him, like a man found frozen in the Arctic snows. Dr. Baudet's movements were leisurely. He stepped off his pedestal with the mincing care of a lady alighting from a bus. The platform stood about 2 feet from the ground, and above the edge of it, a plush-covered rope hung in arc-like curves. Dr. Baudet lifted up the rope until it formed an arch for him to pass under, stepped off the platform, and sat down on the edge, facing Hewson. Then he nodded and smiled and said,
"Good evening. I need hardly tell you that not until I overheard the conversation between you and the worthy manager of this establishment did I suspect that I should have the pleasure of a companion here for the night. You cannot move or speak without my bidding, but you can hear me perfectly well. Something tells me that you were, shall I say, nervous. My dear sir, I have no illusions. I am not one of these contemptible effigies miraculously come to life. I am Dr. Baudet himself."
He paused, coughed, and shifted his legs.
Pardon me, but I am a little stiff. Please, let me explain. Circumstances with which I need not fatigue you have made it desirable that I should live in England. I was close to this building this evening when I saw a policeman regarding me, I thought, a little too curiously. I guessed that he intended to follow and perhaps ask me embarrassing questions, so I mingled with the crowd and came in here. A coin bought my admission to the chamber in which we now meet, and an inspiration showed me a certain means of escape. I raised a cry of fire, and when all the fools had rushed to the stairs, I stripped my effigy of the caped coat which you behold me wearing, donned it, hid my effigy under the platform at the back, and took its place on the pedestal. The manager's description of me, which I had the embarrassment of being compelled to overhear, was biased, but not altogether inaccurate. Clearly, I am not dead, although it is as well that the world think otherwise, no? His account of my hobby, which I have indulged for years, although through necessity, less frequently of late, was in the main true. For you see, the world is divided between collectors and non-collectors. With the non-collectors, we are not concerned, eh? The collectors collect anything according to their individual tastes, from money to cigarette cards, from malls to matchboxes. I collect throats.
He paused again and regarded Hewson's throat with interest, mingled with disfavor.
I am obliged to the chance which brought us together tonight, and perhaps it would seem ungrateful to complain. From motives of personal safety, my activities have been somewhat curtailed of late years, and I am glad of this opportunity of gratifying my somewhat unusual whim. But you, sir, you have such a skinny neck. If you will overlook a personal remark, I should never have selected you from choice. I like men with thick necks. Thick red necks.
He fumbled in an inside pocket and took out something which he tested against a wet forefinger and then proceeded to pass gently to and fro across the palm of his left hand.
This is a little French razor. The blade, you will observe, is very narrow. They do not cut very deep, but deep enough. In just one little moment, you shall see for yourself. And now, I shall ask you the little civil question of all the polite barbers. Does the razor suit you, sir?
He rose up, a diminutive but menacing figure of evil, and approached Hewson with a silent, furtive step of a hunting panther.
You will have the goodness to raise your chin a little, eh? Oh, thank you. And a little more, just a little more. Ah, thank you. Merci, monsieur. Merci, merci. Ah, merci.
Over one end of the chamber was a thick skylight of frosted glass, which by day let in a few sickly and filtered rays from the floor above. After sunrise, these began to mingle with the subdued light from the electric bulbs. And this mingled illumination added a certain ghastliness to a scene which needed no additional touch of horror. The waxwork figures stood apathetically in their places, waiting to be admired or execrated by the crowds who would presently wander fearfully among them. In their midst, in the center gangway, Hewson sat still, leaning far back in his swivel chair. His chin was up-tilted as if he were waiting to receive attention from a barber. And although there was not a scratch upon his throat, nor anywhere upon his body, he was cold and dead. Dr. Baudet, on his pedestal, watched the dead man unemotionally. He did not move, nor was he capable of motion. But then, after all, he was only a waxwork.
In which William Conrad starred in tonight's presentation of The Waxwork.
Suspense, on Tuned to Yesterday from May 1st, 1956 on CBS. William Conrad in one of his greatest roles on radio. Of course, he was Marshal Matt Dillon on Gunsmoke, but essentially a one-man show really brought out his talent. The same episode would be repeated again in 1959 with movie actor Herbert Marshall taking on that same duty. This is an hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for Inner Sanctum with a story called The Death Deal, an Armed Forces radio service rebroadcast from April 18th, 1949.
Good evening, friends. This is your host to welcome you through the creaking door into the Inner Sanctum. Want to listen to a story that'll age you 10 years and a half hour? Huh? Oh, come on, Ed. You can't be happy all the time. I'm just going through my mail. Perhaps I can answer a few questions. Let's see. Oh, yeah, to the lady from Peoria. My answer, no, madam. I've only died once. To that transparent man in Detroit. Ghosts do not have to pay income tax. And to that dear little lady living in a coffin in San Francisco, a very happy 800th birthday. All right, friends. It's time to turn down the lights, settle yourselves comfortably in a chair, and find out how gruesome life can be. Now remember, if you hear someone screaming, it may be you. Ready? Then let's get ghoulish. It's early evening, and the rather prosperous-looking gentleman in the diner, whom we shall call Roger Aldriss, looks up at the man sitting next to him when he feels his elbow gently tapped. Roger Aldriss couldn't tell you why he feels a sudden icy tingle in his elbow where the man touched him, or why his heart suddenly throbs with fear as he sees the bloodless white face of the man who now talks to him.
Aldriss. Roger Aldriss, that's your name, isn't it?
Yes. Have we met?
This is the first time.
Glad to know you,
Mr. Mortmain.
It's an odd name, Mortmain. How do you do?
Excuse me for not shaking your hand. I don't shake people's hand as a rule.
Why not?
People generally don't like it. Is that your car outside, the blue one next to the fence?
Yes.
Don't drive it tonight.
Why not?
You will be killed in it.
What makes you think so?
I know.
Oh, no, really, Mr. Mortmain, I do think... Oh, wait a minute. Someone's getting into my car.
So I see.
I left the keys in it. He's driving it away.
He won't get very far.
I've got to stop him. Hey, come back here.
You're too late, Mr. Algren.
I'll call the police.
It won't do any good. Watch.
An explosion. The car's going up in flames. Good heavens. That man who stole it... I would have been killed.
Yes. You have another chance to live, Mr. Algren.
How did you know? Who are you?
We shall meet again sometime, Mr. Algren. Good night.
Yes? What is it?
I'm Detective Sergeant Lane of the police department. Here's my shield. May I come in?
Yes, of course.
Are you Mrs. Algris, Mrs. Roger Algris?
Yes, I am. Why?
You'd better sit down. I've some very bad news.
Bad news?
Yes, please sit down.
Yes, all right.
Your husband was killed in an automobile accident tonight.
Roger was killed?
Yes, ma'am.
Where?
Near a country diner, just a few miles from here.
Roger is an excellent driver. I don't understand how he...
We don't understand it ourselves yet. It's sort of a freak accident. The car seemed to explode, then the flame shot up.
Oh, no.
It must have been over in an instant for him. But the body, well, you'll have to come to the morgue and make identification of it in the morning.
Are you quite sure it was my husband's body?
Who else could it be?
Yes, who else?
I'm sorry to bring you such terrible news, Mrs. Augusta. May I extend my deepest sympathy?
Yes, thank you.
I'll call again at 10 in the morning. Good night.
Good night. Dennis? Dennis, it's all right to come out now.
Helen.
Dennis, I have something very strange to tell you.
Yes, I know. I heard what he said. Helen, do you realize what this means for us? You'll have everything. And with this accident, you'll receive double indemnity on the insurance.
Please, Dennis, don't talk about it now.
But why not? Surely you're not going to pretend that you cared for
him. No, I hated him. Oh, when something like this happens, you... I'm a little frightened.
Well, why should you be? You're free. We can marry.
Yes, I know, but...
You're trembling, darling. Come here.
Dennis.
Nothing matters but us now. We don't have to live in constant terror any longer. For the first time, I can kiss you and feel that you're really mine.
No, Dennis, don't.
What? Oh. Who's that?
I don't know. You'd better go back into the other room.
All right.
Hurry.
Good evening, Helen.
Roger.
Yes, Roger.
Oh, but it can't be. You... They told me you were dead.
You'd like that, wouldn't you?
What?
You wish I were dead, don't you?
Roger, don't.
But I'm not. A woman who loved her husband would throw her arms about his neck if he returned as I've returned now.
Well, it's just the shock. I'm upset.
Are you?
Yes.
Sit down, Helen.
But Roger...
Sit down, I said.
Yes.
That police officer who was here a moment ago reported that I was dead, didn't he?
Yes, I don't understand.
A very strange thing happened, Helen. Maybe before this evening's over, you may have your wish. And I'll be dead and out of your life forever, if that's what you want. You'd like that, wouldn't you, dear?
You're being very theatrical.
Oh, no. For once in my life, I'm being very practical. I've decided I can't live without you.
Well, Roger, you know the alternative.
You're making a clumsy attempt to be witty, but as it turns out, that's just how I solved my problem.
What's holding you back?
I don't believe in suicide. Here, take my gun.
What am I supposed to do? Kill you?
Exactly.
Oh, but you can't be serious.
I am. Consider it, Helen. I've been reported dead. The poor fool who stole my car was burned to death. Identification is impossible, but the police will take your word for it that the wreck of the person you'll see tomorrow at the morgue... is me. You're in a position to commit a perfect murder.
You know, Roger, for the first time in years, I find you interesting.
I thought you would.
Tell me exactly how to murder you.
It's quite simple. You have a gun in your hand.
Oh, that part is easy. Even pleasant. But how would I get rid of your body? Really, darling, it would be embarrassing to explain away your corpse.
In a moment, I'm going to the garage to take the station wagon at a time.
Why? Where are you going?
To the police. If you don't kill me, I want to clear up the matter of the mistaken identity. However, if you want me to die, I suggest you murder me in the garage.
Why there?
It'd be so much more convenient.
Oh, I see. I won't have to drag your bleeding body through the house.
Exactly.
But then where would I take you?
Well, I suggest the bridge. No one uses it at this hour. My body would be washed out to sea. It would be days before it was found, and again, identification would be practically impossible.
And so you've worked out a perfect plan. Well, there must be a catch to it.
What?
I'm sure you figure me to end up in the electric chair, even though you may kill yourself to do it.
Helen, if this sounds like the idea of a madman, maybe it is. You're the most beautiful woman I've ever met. I love you beyond reason, despite the fact that I know you have as much character as an alley cat. Tonight, I think it was you, perhaps with the assistance of my very dear friend Dennis, who was responsible for my car blowing up.
You think I tried to murder you?
That's just it. I don't know. But I can't go on not trusting you, thinking you want to murder me. I've got to know once and for all. Now, do you understand?
Yes, you're right. It is the plan of a madman. But then you always have been a little mad.
Well, maybe I am. I know what you do the moment I leave the house, and I still come crawling back to you. I tried 1,000 times to walk out, and I can't. If you had any money, you'd have left me long ago. But you can get all my money only if I die. And so I'm giving you an opportunity because I must know. I must know if you could murder me. And now do you believe that this isn't all some monstrous joke?
Yes. I believe you are serious.
But I walk out of here and go to the garage. It may be the last time I'll see you. I should like to kiss you goodbye. You're still my wife, you know.
Yes. Oh.
Now, there's one thing more. Something I've waited a long time to do.
What?
This. That's for Dennis. And that's for all the others. The gun's in your hand, Helen. If you use it, please be thorough and empty it completely. After the pain you caused me during my life, the least you can do is to let me die quickly. And, by the way, you can tell Dennis he can come out as soon as I leave. Good night. Good night, Helen.
Dennis.
I heard what he said. It's some trick.
No, it's not. It's not a trick. I know him well enough to know that.
Well, you're not going to do it, are you?
He's testing me, Dennis. And now I'm going to test you. Will you help me?
Well, I don't know. Murder.
Dennis, we've only a minute to decide. Answer me, Dennis.
There he is, Helen.
Helen! Is that you, Helen?
Yes, it's me.
Oh, Dennis, too. How very cozy. Oh, where's the gun?
Right here. In my hand.
I didn't think you had the courage. I...
Helen, are you sure?
I'll make certain.
No, Helen!
Put him in the back of the car, Dennis. Then drive to the bridge.
Several weeks have passed since Roger Allgrist was murdered. And this evening we find Helen at home alone, moodily staring out the window at the storm that rages outside.
Oh,
Helen.
Dennis, why did you come here?
I must see you.
But I told you, I don't want people to talk.
Please let me in. I've got to speak
but
to
I
you.
But I don't want you to... Oh, all right. Now, what's wrong?
I don't know. Maybe I'm losing my mind.
What are you talking about?
I saw him again tonight.
Roger?
Yes, Roger, your husband, the man we murdered.
Stop it, Vince.
No, I must say it. I saw Roger, your husband, the man we killed in the garage, whose body we dropped in the river.
Dennis, please.
I'm sorry, Helen. I didn't mean to become hysterical. I can't help it.
No, I suppose you can't. You've always been more of a woman than a man.
Helen!
It's perfectly true. You're acting like a frightened schoolgirl. You've no more courage than a worm.
I wonder if you enjoy this abuse you've taken to lately.
No, not particularly. I'd like to say something nice to you, but you give me no reason to.
I can see now why Roger hated you. You're treating me just like you treated him. And I thought you loved me.
Oh, stop it. If you've got something to tell me, let me hear it.
All right. He was in my house this time. Not staring through the window as I saw him before, or in the garden where I saw him last week. He was in my living room. I saw him walk out, close the door.
Darling, why didn't you stop him and apologize for murdering him?
You still think this is some sort of joke?
No, far from it. But if you don't get a grip on your nerves, something very unpleasant may happen. And I've too much to lose to let you go about in the state you're in. I suppose somebody hears about your stupid hallucinations. Somebody who might start investigating.
What would you do, Helen?
What do you think I'd do?
Murder me as you murdered Roger?
Darling, please, don't be melodramatic.
But you'd kill me.
Maybe.
Helen!
Now, please get out of here. Actually, the notion of murdering you has a certain pleasure which I find very tempting. And don't come back here with any more of your idiotic stories.
Good evening, Dennis.
Roger.
Yes, Roger. I've been waiting here for you to get home.
You're alive?
No.
But you're sitting there talking to me.
Well, you know this doesn't exist just in your mind. There are no witnesses to prove my existence. Yet, here I am. You care to touch me to confirm your doubts?
No!
I don't blame you. You couldn't touch me. I'm dead, Dennis. These are the clothes I wore when I was murdered. Here are the wounds. The blood from the bullets flowing all over my shirt.
What? Why did you come here?
A few weeks ago, Helen gave you the pistol she used when she murdered me. It was a sort of token, a bond you demanded to seal your partnership in crime.
How do you know that?
The dead see everything. Tonight, just before you arrived, I saw Helen take the gun out of the desk drawer where you keep it.
But it's gone.
Yes.
Why did she take it?
It might be evidence that would interest the police if you were found murdered.
She really is going to murder me?
You've always been weak and stupid, Dennis. But I think her whole plan must be finally clear to you by now. She knows you're going to pieces, and she plans to murder you as soon as possible.
Yeah, but what can I do?
Go back to her. If you don't destroy her, she'll destroy you. Act quickly.
Hello?
Mrs. Aldriss, this is a friend of yours. I'm calling because your life is in danger.
What?
Dennis Wilcox is on his way to your home to murder you. Goodbye.
Hello, hello, who are you? You, hello? Yes, who's there?
It's me, Dennis.
Dennis? Just a moment.
Let me in.
What do you want?
Just to see if I can find something.
Why are you going through that desk?
Just to make certain that I... Here it is.
What?
Roger's gun. The one you used to murder him.
I thought you had that.
It's no use lying any longer, Helen. I know why you stole it from me. You planned to murder me, but you won't get away with it. You're going to die first.
Dennis, stop.
No!
I...
Oh, help. That gun, where did you get that gun?
Someone warned me you'd try this.
Oh, Helen, send for a doctor. My chest.
You think I'd help you now?
You have to help me. I once helped you. Get a doctor.
Dennis?
Well done, Helen.
What?
Good evening, Helen.
What?
You could put the gun down, darling. Don't bother to try to shoot me. Your gun is empty.
You're alive.
Alive? I sometimes wonder.
What did you do?
Are you really interested, Helen? Maybe you'll be happier if you're put to death and never knew what I did.
Put to death?
For the murder of Dennis.
So that's it. That's what you wanted to happen.
Yes, and it will. The police will be here in a moment.
And you arranged for that, too?
Yes. You must admit I have a certain talent for making arrangements.
Why didn't you die when I killed you?
Because, darling, though I may be your husband, I don't do everything you want me to. The bullets in the gun I gave you back in the garage were blanks.
They were...
Yes. It was easy. I knew you and Dennis wouldn't take the trouble to examine my body.
And you counted on Dennis's weakness to arrange for my execution.
Yes. You may not love me, Helen, but you do know me well. As soon as I hear the police sirens coming up the road, I'll leave.
You won't get away with this.
Oh, yes, I will. I have a car waiting outside. Everything is all
planned. Why did you do this to me? Why? What?
Because I wanted to discover if you're a murderess. And I found out you were. And so I arranged for you to pay in full for everything you've done.
I won't die. I won't.
The sirens.
Yes.
Well, Helen... You'll have a chance to explain why you won't die to the gentleman who'll come through that door in a moment. I'm afraid I must go now. And I'm afraid I must use the back door. Goodbye.
Roger, take me with you.
Don't be ridiculous.
Please, Roger.
Take your hands off me.
No, Roger, no.
Forgive me for being a little rough.
Sergeant, open the door. It's the police.
Oh, just a moment.
Sergeant, we've received a strange telephone call about... Oh, I see I'm too late. You murdered him.
No, officer, no. My husband murdered him.
Your husband?
Yes. He just ran out of the house. You'd better go after him quickly.
Mrs. Aldrich, your husband is dead.
No, he's not.
But you identified him in the morgue. I was with
him. But that was a mistake. I didn't... Oh, what's the use? You wouldn't believe me anyway. What kind of call did you receive about me?
Someone said you planned to kill Mr. Wilcox. And I see that you have. You're under arrest for murder, Mrs. Aldrich.
Good evening, Mr. Aldrich.
Who are you?
Don't you remember me?
Mr. Mortney.
Yes.
What are you doing in my car?
Waiting for you to come along. I once did you a favor. I thought that you might drive me just to the crossroads. It's difficult to walk in this storm.
Yes, of course. I'll take you wherever you want to go.
Mr. Aldrich.
Yes?
I must say, I don't think you did very well with the chance to live that I gave you.
What do you know about it?
Everything.
Well, how? Who are you, anyway?
Perhaps I'm just someone you imagine. Someone who doesn't exist.
But I can see you. I can speak to you.
We can see and speak to the creations of our minds. Sometimes they are more real than the people of flesh and blood who can be killed.
Your name, Mr. Mortman. I know what it means.
Do you?
Yes. It means the hand of death. Why did you come to me tonight? Do you think I've done wrong? Can't you see I couldn't go on living with her, that I had to become free of her? Now I'll be able to make something of my life.
Will you? Mr. August, drop me here, please.
Very well.
By the way, Mr. August, before I go, I have a message for you. Here. It's written out. Good night.
Good night. Message. I better read it. Where's that dashboard light? Dear Mr. Allgrist, by the time you finish reading this, it will be too late. Mortmain. Now what could he... The car. There's something wrong.
I'll bet you next time Roger's alive, he'll know better than to marry a woman who's going to kill him. And wasn't that Helen a charming girl? The kind of woman who'll love you till you die. And she'll see to it that you'll die soon. Which brings us to the moral of our story, which we found on the walls of the tomb of King Tut, Tut, Tut. Never ask your wife if she'd like to murder you. You may be surprised at her answer. Good night. Pleasant dreams.
Inner Sanctum, on Tuned to Yesterday from April 18, 1949, an Armed Forces Radio Service rebroadcast, bringing to a close this hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Livonier. Thanks for listening.